I want to go back to the moment of your trauma and the moment that you found out that your lives would never ever be the same again.
Sure, come along. There was definitely, through the dancing, there came a level of bullying and people making fun of me for my choices and so forth. Not something that boys do at that young age, so I was ridiculed for that.
What was your coping mechanism?
I just pretended they weren't there, and then I pretended I wasn't there either. I think it's crazy that we don't realize that the negative things can actually be turned into positives later down the way, if you can look at them that way. So I have a daughter who has developmental delays, and she has epilepsy. So my inspiration for the podcast was always to tell parts of her story, but at the same time, find other people that have gone through some form of adversity or something that has sort of shaped them into who they are. And with that, some assembly required. Understand that it's not the end. It does change things, let's be honest. But it's not the end. There's still plenty joy to be had. And I think that's really powerful when you come to understand that your joy just looks different.
Sean.
Marco.
You are an award-winning radio presenter and podcast host. You're a producer, creative strategist, husband, and dedicated dad. But you have had quite a journey to become the person that you are today. What is the earliest context that we need to understand about you to understand Sean better?
Great question. Thanks for having me on the show. I think my earliest recollection, when you asked me what would have impacted me to be the person that I am today, is probably dancing. But at the same time, my swimming was a big part of my adolescence, and prior to that even, really young. So maybe through both of those, the sport, the healthy body, healthy mind, physical exercise, being on stage, created the person that you see in front of you today. I think in a good way and in a bad way, those two things have probably shaped me. There was a fair amount of bullying that came through that. There was a lot of achievement that came through that. There was being on stage and being seen, which people interpreted as enjoying the spotlight, which I really don't. Mm-hmm. So I think those things maybe, and to give you some context, I was probably around 7 or 8 when I started dancing, modern dancing. It's not something that boys do at that young age, so I was ridiculed for that. And swimming was just something that I naturally took to. So that was also really great that I managed to progress the way that I did through being in the water, but I threw myself into the swimming to the extent that, you know, schoolwork and so forth would suffer. And I never got to compete at the Olympics, surprisingly enough.
Damn
so
it.
Why did I do all of that to myself? Yeah. Anyway.
Why do you think those two specific directions in your life? Like, why do you think dancing and sport? What was it about movement that enticed you that much? Was it something that was modeled to you and you thought, like, I like that, I want to dedicate my life to that, or at least a season, or what went through your head?
If I were more closely related to someone like Patrick Swayze, maybe it would have been modeled to me. But neither of my parents were exceptionally active, especially not at that young, when I was that young. So it wouldn't have been modeled by anybody very close to me. And that would be the dancing thing. It was definitely television, having seen the movies, and I just thoroughly enjoyed moving. I guess I was just good at it. I have natural flexibility, and being on stage was a fun thing to do. To move to music was fun. As far as the swimming is concerned, there was some lineage. My dad was a swimmer. He was a water polo player. My mom enjoyed being in the water. So there was probably some form of a push from their side to at least explore it. Having said that, neither of them would have told me I have to attend a practice. It was always, are you going to swimming today, right? When I got in this car after school, are we going to dancing today? It was always my choice. I was never forced to do anything. So I can't actually say to you whether it was somebody close to me that was inspiring me to do those things, or if it was just a desire to be... Actually, I don't know. I don't have an answer for you. I can't say it was a desire to be seen, because I have a great family life. So I might have to think on that a little bit harder still.
Interesting. So it might have just been a way that you wanted to express yourself. Like, this is what I enjoy doing, and that's what I want to do.
Yeah, I think if I think back now as well, early school, primary school, when I was dancing, I was also involved in poetry and I Steadfords and so forth. I was good on stage. Not that I enjoyed being the center of attention. I was just good on stage. I think I could command attention, which sounds weird now. But if you listen back to all the things you've listed about my life, not all that surprising, hey? And it's worked out well for me. I've been able to control it. So, yes, I was on stage a lot. I thoroughly enjoyed being on stage. Interestingly, to this day, it's more difficult for me to have a conversation with a small group of people than it is for me to stand on stage. I think the people in front of me become a C, and I can do what I want to do, and I can express myself through a script, through movement, through whatever the things might be. There's some form of control that I have. Whereas if I'm at a dinner party and there are only three other people there, I become very anxious because I feel like I have to entertain, and I can see these three faces are going to respond to anything I have to say. And there was definitely, through the dancing, there came a level of bullying and fun and people making fun of me for my choices and so forth. So I didn't stick with the dancing for very long. It's something that I regret to this day. I wish I had stuck it out because now it's super cool. I mean, imagine being able to pull off those TikTok dances without looking silly. So, you know, there's good and bad that came from those things. And the swimming aspect, you know, people can't see you cry behind goggles is something I've heard other swimmers say. Not that I can say I was crying when I was in the water, but there is a level of being in your own head. It's a sport that there's a team around, but you're very much a soloist. You know, your achievements are going to be based on whether or not you are pushing yourself hard enough. And I think for me, the swimming was very much a sense of community. Again, I never got to the Olympic Games. I wasn't that good of a swimmer, but I dedicated a lot of my time to being at the pool, to being with the people, to being part of the team. And that was very important for me. Again, maybe if I had actually applied myself when I was in the water, because I was there every day, I did the training 2 hours twice a day, 7 days a week. Maybe if I'd applied myself, I would have been able to say I also won a gold medal at the Olympic Games. But in hindsight, hey, like we never know. We just never know.
How did you treat the bullying, like at that age? What was your coping mechanism?
To pretend it didn't exist, I think. Obviously, I didn't enjoy it. Nobody does. Nobody wants to be made fun of. I really felt like I had a very small group of friends. And to be honest, it was probably the coping mechanism was to pretend that it didn't affect me. And then through that, you just sort of isolate yourself. I can see that now. I can see now that because I would, again, turn a blind eye or pretend I didn't hear it, I've definitely developed a very high EQ. I'm aware of when people around me are feeling certain things and I can adjust to that. If I walk into a room and I can feel there's a sense from the far side that's judging me, I just won't go there. And that's probably from primary school days, right? Being able to see kids looking at me and sniggering or pointing or laughing or calling me names and so forth. I didn't have very many guy friends, and the girl friends were just that much easier to hang out with, right? Because they didn't seem to be as judgy. So yeah, it was hard. It was hard. I don't know that I had a coping mechanism other than to pretend it didn't exist. There wasn't anything else that I did in reaction to. I didn't have a temper. I didn't flare out on things. I wasn't acting out other ways. I just pretended they weren't there. And then I pretend I wasn't there either.
There's something that kind of comes to mind now. But before the podcast started, we had a discussion about the ability of reading a room and knowing what people think or kind of conveying a conversation or guiding a conversation and reading people very well. And I said to you, it's such a powerful quality and unique quality to have, especially in entrepreneurship. And as you spoke through that experience now, I thought about, I also experienced bullying at school. And it's also something that I feel that I can do rather well, is to manage the emotion when you enter a room or a conversation or something like that. And I think there might actually be something there. It might be something that gets birthed out of you feeling like you're experiencing the bully and you're feeling sad or like just like embarrassed or whatever. So you like either resort to humor or anger or whatever, choose your outlet. But I definitely think that it might be something there in terms of how we translate that experience of having to do something like that to just cope and get through this moment, and then getting into our 20s and 30s and 40s and actually using that skill that we've adopted at childhood or younger years and then translating it into a very effective business skill, actually.
Mm. Yeah, I think it's crazy that we don't realize that those the negative things can actually be turned into positives later down the way if you can look at them that way. And traumatic experiences, everybody goes through something that's traumatic. We're going to face some form of adversity at some point in our lives and to varying degrees. And with the bullying, I think at the time I didn't really realize what it was or how it was impacting me, probably because I would ignore it as if it didn't exist. And through that, maybe you develop resilience and tenacity and the capacity to shoulder more things because you just soldier on. It could also work out really badly if you keep doing that to your own detriment. But in my case, I think I channeled it into other things, like eventually into the swimming and threw myself into that, now into work, and I can throw myself into something. I can read people pretty well, I think, based on that negative experience. So there might very well be something there, like you say. I don't know if there's a study with regards to the after effects of bullying 20 years on, what those people have gone on to do and how they've used it. Yeah,
I'll definitely look into that this afternoon.
Please do.
I'll send you a link.
Yeah.
So you started a podcast called Some Assembly Required.
I did.
Why did you start the podcast and why that name?
Beautiful question. So I have a daughter who has developmental delays and she has epilepsy. And her brain is wired in such a way that things take a lot longer for her to register them. So the structure of her brain wasn't fully developed when she was born. And that's what's caused the epilepsy. So when many people hear me talk about I have a young daughter that's got epilepsy, they say, oh, I'm sure she'll grow out of it. It'll be fine. And I go, thank you very much. That's really sweet of you. However, the way her brain developed means that there are parts of it that just haven't developed yet. And because it's not developed, things are misfiring. That's what's causing the epilepsy. So I know many people see the epilepsy as the bigger issue because they kind of understand what epilepsy is. But from a developmental standpoint, what my goal is very much to help her develop the things that people say she won't be able to do. And I know that sounds very lofty and like I'm an idealist. But if I take you back to the very first neurologist that saw her after seeing her MRI, with no other conversations with us or any interactions with us, of the first words that fell out of his mouth to us were that she's a plane we cannot fix. I'll never forget it. Which essentially he was saying is you're working with something here that's broken and you can't repair it. It's just that is the way it is. So for me, the analogy of some assembly required is that there's a DIY aspect to many things. And I love putting furniture together and DIYing, and you can obviously tell that, you know, I find my way through things. There's some assembly required to our lives. You know, we're building things, we're building blocks. And in Zoe's case, it's a case of building her up and giving her the support that she needs. So my inspiration for the podcast was always to tell parts of her story, but at the same time, find other people that have gone through some form of adversity or something that has sort of shaped them into who they are. And with that, some assembly required. Oddly enough, it was inspired. The name popped into my head after watching a Marvel movie, and when the Avengers come together, there's some assembly required. So that's how I eventually got to the name. But it all makes sense when you take the entire picture and put it all together. I had a podcast prior to that, which I called Unstoppable, which was also very much inspired by her, and that's just the tenacity to keep on going and to keep on keeping on. So some assembly required has run its course. In fact, it still exists. The conversation still exists, the podcast still exists, but I've changed the name. Reason being that everything in my life has sort of shifted, and while I still believe there is some assembly required to many things, it takes time for these things to be put into place, for the building blocks to be placed correctly or to be shifted again. And that's where I'm finding myself now. I feel less compelled to tell stories about the building, but more about the shifting, about how we start to realize that something has changed, and then what is that thing that changed that got you to where you are now? So I've renamed the podcast to Something Shifted. All the stories are still the same, but it resonates a little bit better for me now. Zoe's in a really great space, and I think that is probably a lot of the inspiration behind the shift. Similarly, I felt that the podcast, the branding and all that, for the longest time, just didn't quite hit the mark. I mean, it means a lot to me, but from a podcast listener connection, understanding, like get it the first time you see it standpoint, many people still thought I was talking about DIY. And to try and convince them or to show them the connection, it takes a little bit longer to explain, whereas I think Something Shifted says it a lot faster.
In the time frame that you had that this Some Assembly Required podcast, what were some of the things that you worked through or went through, some of the assembly parts that
beautiful.
You fixed and changed to get you to the point where you can say now something has shifted?
So the very first episode was really just unpacking the fact that many people would refer to me as the dad in the hospitals. And so I titled the first episode, I Am Just a Dad. But through that episode, I worked through the process that I'm a lot more than that. Although I'm not a qualified therapist or counselor or psychologist in any way, shape, or form, I have skin in the game in the fact that I've gone through trauma, I've gone through burnout, I've gone through a lot of things, and I'm more than just a dad. The second episode, I explored nervous systems because I came to learn that I was experiencing a lot of pain. And despite seeing physiotherapists, the pain just didn't go away. And I was starting to understand more and more that my body is holding the trauma. So cerebrally, mentally, I have gone, it's cool, it's over, I've dealt with it, it's fine. Which might take us back to my dancing days where I just said, it's okay, we're powering through. And I was starting to realize that actually my body is holding a lot of that information still. So the pain is sitting in places that I just cannot alleviate it. Yes, there's been overuse of my shoulders. Yes, I've done, you know, maybe exerted myself too much. But underlying was that the nervous system was completely shot. So I explore nervous system regulation. I explored sleep and the power of sleep because that also has a lot to do with the way we are put together if we're not getting good quality sleep. I spoke with a sports psychologist with regards to mental tenacity and performance and peak performance and being able to maintain that and the good and the bad. And then I started to explore conversations with authors and with those that have done things, visualization techniques and being able to, Jono Proudfoot swam from Madagascar to Mozambique, phenomenal swim. But prior to that, you know, he was called all sorts of names. He was told he would never achieve anything. He'd lost businesses. Things had failed. But after that swim, it catapulted him into this arena that he obviously dreamed of being successful. He's the guy behind the Real Meal Revolution. He's the guy that approached Tim Noakes and said, can we take this into sports? He's the guy that developed that entire business. So mental tenacity and visualization. Oh, and he was sick the day they got on the boat to go and do the swim, which is over 400 kilometers long. So understanding that, you know, we all have these things that are sitting somewhere inside us that we're probably trying to prove to others we're capable of something. I haven't quite been able to distill what it is, the commonality between all of my guests yet, which would probably be a nice study to go and do. From John Sarnay's following your thread of curiosity and just seeing where that goes, to Jono Proudfoot's visualizations. Terrence, we spoke about ADHD and being diagnosed in his late 30s and then fully understanding why he had, you know, gone through the world the way that he had. Dealing with therapy, people that have really come close to taking their own lives and then realized that there's so much more to it. And through that, those are the types of stories we've been telling with Some Assembly Required. They've been fascinating. And I suppose through all of those conversations, I see a little bit of myself. And I can reflect back the things that I've learned and then start to garner just a little bit more energy to move on and go, okay, this makes sense. I'm not alone. Okay, that makes sense. Okay, that's how they dealt with it. And slowly but surely, you start to realize that your state, your mental state has shifted from I'm falling apart to, oh, I'm actually a little bit more whole because the people around me are going through the same things. It's not just me that's feeling incomplete. Everybody feels that way, and so forth.
Yeah.
The shift.
I think there's so much power in having these conversations. Like, I think the dialogue that you used when you said you're not a psychologist or a psychiatrist or therapist or is like you lived the credentials, and that was so powerful to me in terms of like sometimes I think that gives you a little, not more authority, but it gives you a better understanding, like you've actually been through this. So when you talk about this stuff, yes, you've done your research and you know what terms to use to explain the disease or the condition or the trauma or whatever, but this, you've got this level of emotion that you can add to it. Like I've heard the sentence that this plane is broken. Like I've been through like that whole experience, and you add the head knowledge to that, which I think is super powerful. And then you add another layer with the stories, which kind of brings the sense of community, and there's all kinds of stuff that all of us are going through. I want to go back to the moment of your trauma and the moment that you found out that your lives would never, ever be the same again. Invite us into that room.
Sure, come along.
Bring a backpack.
Yeah, how long do you have? Yeah, I can try and talk you through, you know, that the realization that things are going to be a lot harder. And I think it came at different times from both my wife and myself. She processes things very quickly and is, again, also very in tune with her emotions. And she outwardly expresses those quickly. I, on the other hand, process internally. And only at a later stage will I go, oh, that's how I was feeling. And then, so I think we got to that realization at different times. And therefore, we were slightly, on slightly different pages through most of it. Fortunately, though, we work in such a way where when things are in dire straits, I was going to use another phrase now and I decided not to, then we complement one another exceptionally well. So I think our relationship actually got a lot stronger through the process of realizing that our lives are never going to quite be the same. But to take you all the way back to 2015, Zoe was born in 2016, early 2016. In 2015, there were scans. They were saying things weren't quite right, but they didn't know what. And then it was only after Zoe was born, the beginning of 2016, 6 months later, that she had this episode that we didn't know what it was. And through that, we spent a good 50-odd days in Red Cross Children's Hospital, thankfully an academic hospital, thankfully lots of multidisciplinary stuff going on. Thankfully, they took the situation quite seriously. We just wanted to get out of there. But again, in hindsight, it was really great that we spent so long there because we got a clearer understanding of what was going on. And it was through that, I suppose, the drawn out being in hospital day in and day out. You can't sleep in the same room necessarily because you're in this ward of all these, I call them cages. That's what they felt like now. They were cots. They're metal cots. And there are six or so small children in the same room. And you're preventing them from falling out. And they're beeping machines and they're nodes that are stuck on them. And in that case, and Zoe had feeding tubes as well. And all of that that's going on. You've got wires on your child all the time. I didn't realize that it was traumatic at the time, right? Again, just power through, just keep on going. We climbed stairs every single day. It's like four flights of stairs that you climb. We were the fittest we'd ever been, I think. We also drank way too much coffee. But it was during that time that one of our friends, who's also a doctor, had come to visit us, and he said, you guys just realize that the difference is you're going to see specialists throughout Zoe's childhood. You're not going to see regular doctors. And that's exactly what's turned out. I think we have every ist. We have one of them on our cell phones, whether it be a psychologist or a nutritionist, a physiotherapist, occupational therapist, neurologist. Like, if it ends in ist, we've seen it. We've done it. And I think it's probably dawning on me maybe even more now how different our lives are going to be, in the sense that when she's small and she's not doing much, that's generally the process of a child. When they're, you know, up to 12 months old, they don't do all that much. But then when they start to develop and they're up on their feet and they're running around and they start to, you know, tell stories, or now we're seeing that big discrepancy, because our friends have got kids at that age are leap years ahead of where Zoe is at. And now I'm investing in things like hoists to be able to lift her and move her from a bed to a chair in the event that she's not strong enough to do it. So I'm planning for things that nobody even wants to think about, because I can't guarantee that I'm going to be able to pick her up. She's strong, and she wants to. She's a tenacious individual. I wonder where she gets that from. But I can't guarantee that I'll be able to pick her up. She doesn't have muscle tone at this point in time, so there's a possibility that she falls ill, and then all of a sudden she becomes a sack of potatoes, for the lack of a better word. And moving her becomes that much more difficult. So what am I doing? I'm putting fail safes in the place. So I need to have a hoist. I need to have wheelchairs. I've got four different chairs on wheels. My house looks very different to many people's houses, because we went through the process of retrofitting it in such a way that it becomes more accessible to wheelchairs. Doors are wider. Light switches are lower. Basins are lower. I'm putting things into place now for hopefully she gets to use in 10, 15 years' time. So yeah, my life changed quite a lot, and I'm thinking about things that many people don't have to process when they've got a small child, right? Mm. Yeah.
How do you deal with that equation?
Because I don't know.
Because like I'm just going through that now. Like for you to see, and I'm not even talking about social media, I'm talking about your friends and the people around you, and you have to daily get to that equation. That's not what you, I don't want to say signed up for, because it sounds so like blasé, but I mean like that you, when you think about having kids or whatever, and I've never actually publicly said this, my wife and I talk about this a lot, but that's probably one of my biggest fears in having children. We don't have children, and I have this thought at the back of my head, like, would I be a strong enough person to handle that? Given the person that I am, the experiences that I've had, and what I see in the future, that equation freaks me out.
Sure.
So, like, how do you, having dealt with that for the last couple of years, on a daily basis, how do you manage yourself, and how do you and Rue kind of stay strong, stay motivated, stay focused on the task ahead? Do you kind of think that... That this is the life that we have now and we work through it? Or how do you approach your day today?
I'll tell you, we don't do it very well. We do it very well outwardly, I suppose, where people see. And ironically, people see you coping and they go, they're fine, they got that, they were made for this, right? In the sense that the phrases like, God only gives children like this to people that can handle it. I'll tell you now, those are not phrases that are very helpful to when the person that's in that situation. But on a day-to-day, it's my life. I don't know it any differently. This is normal to me. So when people talk about when your child is normal or this is a normal behavior, I don't think there's such a thing as normal. I think it's an average behavior, or it's an average experience. In our case, we're extraordinary, you're right? Things are different. That doesn't mean they're worse. It also doesn't mean they're better. So on a day-to-day basis, we're coping with everything from work to home life, like most people do. There's an added level of anxiety that we carry every single day. There's an added level of, how do I keep my child safe and protected? Right now I'm dealing with sleep, in the sense that Zoe has gotten to the point where she's capable of moving herself around and ferociously, like all she wants to do is move. Again, that's, they said she wouldn't, but here she is crawling on all fours and standing up on her feet. She's not stable on her feet, so she falls over. And now you see why I have a problem. I can't sleep through the night, because if she starts moving, she causes herself harm, and she's not aware of that. So those are the levels of things that we're dealing with on any one day. And in terms of coping, I mean, there's medication that helps. There's wine that helps. There's conversations that help. We try and be as real as possible. If somebody says, how was your day? I'll tell you, it wasn't great, you know? And the thing with epilepsy is it's unpredictable. That's why it is what it is. I can't tell you that she's going to have a seizure at 12 o'clock, so I should be home by then, right? She could have a seizure while she's eating, which means she could choke, could cause asphyxiation. It could lead to something getting stuck in her lungs and lead to a long stay in hospital. And again, she doesn't have the strength to be able to sustain that. So the longer she stays in hospital, all of these knock-on effects. So coping is a day at a time, a minute at a time. Are we good now? Yes, we're good now. Are we still good? Yes, we're still good. There's a lot of checking in. I think between my wife and I, Ruwend and I, we check in on one another often. And I think that is also very important for us to maintain a sense of sanity, although it can drive you insane, because we're constantly checking and constantly trying to make sure that everything's okay. So coping is an interesting word that you use. I'm not sure that I think on the outside I am coping fine. Maybe on the inside I'm still processing some of the things. So it really is a day by day. Start the morning, okay, 2 hours in, things are still fine. Another 2 hours in, things are still fine. Add to that the complexity of load shedding and making meals and keeping things cold. And there's always more to think about, I suppose.
Do you think there will come a time where you are comfortable enough with the circumstances and the situation that you and Rue find yourselves in, that your normal day becomes and actually feels quite normal? Mm-hmm. Can you find yourself at a point where you've distance yourself so much from the actual challenges that you have to do? But because kids by default are hard, I will ask this question to somebody that has kids that that does not have a disability. So my question to you is then, like, do you think that there will come a time where you are so comfortable, or not comfortable, because I think comfortable is not the right word to use, but so okay with the situation that you can find your deepest joy and happiness and peace?
Yeah, I think we are there. I think one day to the next may be a little bit more challenging, right? Maybe you didn't sleep as well and therefore the next morning isn't as great, or there's an extra work pressure and then it's not as great. But currently, if I talk you through the day, we weigh out every single meal that Zoe eats because it's part of her medical routine. It's part of her stability. She's on a modified ketogenic diet. So the balance of the ratios of fats to proteins that she eats to carbs, it keeps her brain operating on ketones as opposed to glucose, which means her brain operates at a lower temperature than it would if it was on glucose, which means that it's more stable the way that it is, right? So that means every single meal she eats is weighed out prior to her eating it. I can't just reach into the fridge and give her something when she's hungry, right? We feed her every single meal as well. She's not at that stage yet where she's able to feed herself. That stuff has become very much part of our regular day. She's on anticonvulsants. She's on three different chronic medications. I draw up syringes and dissolve tablets three times a day. It's very normal for me. It's a very ordinary thing. And it is getting to the point now where I feel far more comfortable in the way we do things, that I'm happy to take her out in a buggy or in a wheelchair to a public space and do those things because I'm more comfortable doing that. And I've also gotten to the point where I feel other people need to see her and see us with her. There's a big problem I feel with being isolated. And I think we would all be able to speak to this from a lockdown standpoint. But when you've got a disability or you look different or you move differently to the people around you, you struggle in a space that is sensorially overwhelming, whether it be loud, whether it be bright, whether the floors be difficult to move wheels on, you just don't go there. That means people don't see you. That means you become isolated and you suffer even more from a mental standpoint. So it's important for me to take her out, for me to show her off, right, as a proud parent, and for her to see other spaces and then also sensorially be integrated into those places. So we choose places that are wide open, that are green, that, you know, lots of that aren't heavily, aren't really busy with loads of people. So we're getting to that point, I think, to answer that question. Yes, we're approaching that standpoint where things feel relatively, it's ordinary. It's a regular day, and I'm prepared to, you know, show other people that. 2 or 3 years ago, it was very different because there was always the concern that she would get ill if we left the house. There was always the concern she would have a seizure, which would lead to medication, which might lead to a hospital stay, so you just don't go anywhere. So things are becoming a lot more stable. And from a stability, you know, you can start to work. And again, maybe taking it back to some assembly required, once you've got that foundation, you start to be able to put other layers on top of that without worrying things are going to fall over again, right? For the longest time, it felt like a house of cards. And anything can disrupt that house of cards. Now I think we're building with straw or wood. We're not quite onto brick and mortar just yet. Mm. Yeah.
What advice would you give somebody that maybe have just come out of that diagnosis room?
Goodness,
and,
yeah.
And they know that this, apart from their life changing forever, this is now their reality and what they have to deal with. Like, what do you wish you knew then?
It's a good question in the sense that people would say to me, find a community, speak to others that have gone through this before. And I can tell you, I didn't want to do those things at all. There was definitely a head in the sand, this isn't really happening feeling. And I think we all need to process that. And we do that in our own time. I also can't tell you that it's going to get better because you're going to get used to it. I think that's different than saying it's going to get better in the sense that it's not magically going to go away. You're not going to wake up one morning. I prayed for that plenty times that my child would crawl into the bed with me and just come and snuggle in the morning, right? Because that's a great feeling. She's there now, by the way. But to say to that, to say something like that to someone that's just gone come out of a diagnosis room, I think the best thing is to take the time. I didn't read things on the internet because I didn't want information that was going to cloud my judgment or or fill my mind with things that I really shouldn't be thinking of. I needed to be positive. I needed to be strong. And maybe this is the father aspect here. Somebody needs to be a pillar of strength. He says in air quotes, not that strong, but somebody needs to keep something together that everybody else can rally around. So in hindsight, maybe I would have broken down a bit sooner and dealt with of those things a bit faster to get to where I am now, as opposed to pretending everything's okay and constantly being available to any needs or discrepancies or problems. At the same time, I can't imagine myself turning a blind eye and not showing up to doctor's visits and not being there for any of the physiotherapy sessions or not taking my child swimming, because I know, just deep down, I know that those things are having an impact on the way her brain is now forming. Neuroplasticity-wise, we don't have to just wait for the brain to tell the arms what to do. We can tell the arms what to do, and that can send the signal back to the brain, and that connection starts to be made. So in terms of a parent that gets a diagnosis that they're not expecting or that they're not wanting, I think it's important to sit with it and to grieve it, right? Because that's actually what you're processing, is you've lost something that you thought you were going to have. And we all go through that. Whether you're working towards a dream of an athletic dream or a business dream and something collapses, you're in essence, you're mourning losing something that you didn't necessarily have, but it was this life that you thought you were going to have. And I think that's what we're doing when you get a diagnosis and you're getting something that you weren't expecting. Now your world crumbles. So go through that process. Go through that grieving process, because it's important to get to the other side. Once you get to the other side, things start to look different. I often speak about the mind being like, you know, troubled water, because if it's troubled and turbulent, you just can't see the bottom. But once things start to calm down and you give it time, or if you go further down the stream, right, where there aren't as many rocks and it isn't as turbulent and becomes a lot calmer, you can see the bottom again. It becomes a lot easier to see where you're going. So we need the time, unfortunately. And then, yes, if you're inclined to seek the help and to reach out to have conversations, do that. See a therapist. Gosh, I would have been much better off if I'd started seeing a therapist immediately. I saw a hypnotherapist only once I hit burnout 6 years later. If I had done that sooner... But again, I'm the man, I'm the dad, I'm the pillar of strength. I don't need that, was the dialogue in my head. I hope that parents that receive news that they are never wanting understand that it's not the end. It does change things, let's be honest. But it's not the end. There's still plenty joy to be had. It's not going to look the same as all the Instagram pictures that you're seeing your friends share, but that doesn't mean there isn't joy behind that. And I think that's really powerful when you come to understand that your joy just looks different.
What is your hopes and dreams for Zoe?
Oh, so many. I've had dreams that she dances. I've had dreams where she's talking, where she says words, where she cusses people out for for undermining her. I think it would be wonderful if she got to a point where she was independent to a certain extent. I think every parent wants to know that their child is going off into the world and achieving things. I think I'm very aware of the fact that her achieving things is going to require some form of aids, whether that means being in a wheelchair, having a walking device, having something that helps her along. And if she can get to that independence where she understands that she has authority and she can exercise that on things, I think that's very important for me. To know that she's not always vulnerable is important to me. I don't know how I teach her that. I don't know how I get her to that point. We're always all working towards that. So right now I want her to walk. She's on her feet. Now I want her to walk. And then I want her to talk. And if she can do those two things, I think it'll be amazing. Because then she has the opportunity to express herself and she has the opportunity to go places. Look, it's going to open an entirely new world of things that I hadn't considered in terms of safety and protection and all of those things. But we cross that bridge when we get there. It's another hurdle to overcome.
Hmm. I'm going to ask you a similar question, but just with you and Rue. What are your dreams for you and Rue then?
Happiness, right? Like if I say, like I want Zoe to have some form of independence, I want her to be happy. right? And I think that's going to come with, because I can see how frustrated she is that she can't articulate what she wants, or she can't get where she wants. So deep down, I suppose that's happiness. And I guess the same for my wife. I want her to be happy. I want her to be content. I mean, I'd love for her to have millions of rands in the bank as well and go where she wants to when she wants. But let's be a little bit more on the touchy-feely side here. From an emotional standpoint, I want her to be happy, which means stability. It means understanding that things are the way that they are. And that's not terrible. We're going to have good days. We're going to have bad days. It's the nature of the human experience. If we can get to the point where that fluctuation from good to bad isn't so big, that you can have a bit more of an even-keeled experience, and if that means regulating your nervous system, whether that means making sure that you sleep really well, whether that means that you follow your curiosity and learn new things, but at the heart of it, I just want them to be happy.
Well, you briefly touched on a season of burnout.
Mm.
Take us through that. How did you know that you are burnt out, like this is happening? And how did you grow through and transition through that phase?
I knew I was in burnout when somebody told me. Prior to that, I didn't know that. I also thought that burnout only happens to people that work in corporates, right?
And entrepreneurs, apparently. Yeah. We can chat about that a bit later.
Once I was told I'm in burnout and experiencing some form of PTSD and all of those things, and then I started to think back, I can tell you that I lost my personality. I think you can probably gather that there's a lot of energy and passion behind a lot of the things that I do that had completely dissipated. I can recall sitting on the stoop outside on a summer evening, December, it was probably the end of the year, and I just sat there and I didn't have words to say. And it had been like that for about 3 weeks already. My wife just kept saying, "Are you okay? Where are you? You're not." I was just quiet at home. I operated fine when I was at work, but I just didn't have things to say and I didn't engage. I wasn't looking for anything. There was nothing that sparked any form of joy. And I said to her, "I don't know who I am anymore. I've lost my personality. I don't want to do anything. I don't want to go anywhere. I don't want to see anybody. I don't want to eat anything. I don't want to sleep. I just don't. There's nothing here that I want to do. I don't want to be here. I don't know where to go." And then I can also tell you that there was a year-end party that I attended for work prior to that experience. And I remember getting to the building and there were so many people. I mean, it's a small organization, but there were still so many people, call it 30, let's say, in the break room. And I couldn't be in that room. I went to the room next door, which had another door, and I went into that room and I sat in the furthest corner on a chair and I just tried to be there. But people would call me out, right? Because they want you to come and join the festivities. And I was like, I can't. It's too much noise. There are too many people. I can't think straight. I'm shaking. I don't know what's going on, but I just don't want to be here. And I forced myself to have a conversation with someone. And it was the weirdest experience because she asked me a question and I answered it. And I had this out-of-body moment where I felt myself drift above us and watch me say the things that I was saying to her. And part of my brain was going, "She's not listening to you, Sean. She's bored. You're speaking really slowly." I had an entirely other dialogue happening whilst I was speaking. And she was completely switched off. She was really not engaged in what I was saying. And I was like, "This isn't normal. This doesn't feel right." So that was December of 2019. And I think it had been building from probably about October, November, December, January. I started seeing a hypnotherapist, which worked wonders for me. February, medication. And then I did meds for a good year. I was on antidepressants. I didn't think I was the type of person that ever needed antidepressants. Getting over that hurdle and understanding that these things are here to help boost and aid and lift you just a little bit more so that you can find yourself again. That was also a mental hurdle that I had overcome. But I was very open about the entire experience. I started telling friends and family, "I'm in burnout. I'm in therapy. I'm taking meds. I'm doing this thing. I want you to know where I'm at." And we got through it. I think we got through it. I can see signs now a lot faster if I'm starting to feel a bit more depleted. If sensorially I'm overwhelmed, I know where this is going. And let me try and explain that too, because I live in a house that has got wheelchairs and dogs and tiles, and we're in a relatively closed off area, so it's relatively quiet. So if I tell you that the sound of a bird outside and a fork being dropped and a child that's kicking something sounds like it's inside your head and they're all at various distances, that was enough to make me like run away. And that's exactly what it felt like all the time. The lights were too bright, the sounds were too loud, everything was harsh. My nervous system was completely shot. So burnout was not fun. I don't recommend it ever for anybody.
At any time.
Never.
It's funny that we can laugh about this now.
Yeah, like I know. Hindsight, hey. Yeah. Yeah.
What actually was surprising to me as well, and I can hear it from your story as well, is how long it takes to get better. Because you think that, okay, just change the environment and the circumstances or quit your job or whatever the case might be and you'll be fine. But it's really not that. It really attacks you at soul level and, like you said, nervous system level in terms of the way that you operate, the way that you think, the sounds, the movement, everything. You literally, I always say this equation, like you get zero. Like there's no ups, there's no downs. There's just like this, you're in this subsequent state of living where you just glide through your emotions and the self-talk in your head until you work through it. But I think something that I would recommend now is like going to therapy, or and actually just like you did in terms of expressing the need with your friends and family so they can support you at least at a very close level. And also from my understanding, it was just the day or the year before COVID. So there was that added pressure towards like going through that. Speaking of friends and family, how do you manage friends, family with a busy career, being an entrepreneur now, with everything that you have going on, family life, and stuff like that? You mentioned in terms of isolation and stuff like that. Is that something that you're still struggling or working through?
Definitely. I think 2024 needs to be the year where that becomes more of a focus. And I say it from time to time, I need to find more friends, which is weird because I have a lot of friends. I just don't see them. I don't get a chance to see them. It feels like my day is packed with things that have to be done. Like all of those things are urgent, where they're actually important. They're not urgent. And my friends are just as important, but they always seem to fall by the wayside. And maybe that's a stage of our lives where many of us are either hustling or working really hard and have young families. You know, you go through that stage where you just keep passing one another by and you make plans to get together and things just fall by the wayside. So I can say that when I worked in radio and I had a team of people around me, I felt like I had friends that I was seeing all the time because you're interacting with lots of people on a daily basis. And you get to think that they are your friends and they'll be there all the time. And then when you move out of that space and you don't see those same people day in and day out, you start to realize, well, were they your friends in the first place? Are they still your friends? What do you have in common anymore? And now, because I work from home, I work in an industry that I can do everything on my own. I don't need other people around me. And I work from home because I'm close to where Zoe is. That means that my workday is, as soon as it's done, I jump into being dad and I keep working. That's how the burnout became what it did. So I'm aware of the fact that I need to reach out and see other people. What I am a lot better at doing now is at least sending voice notes or making calls or doing something where I can connect with them. I don't necessarily get to see them as often. And I think that might be a location problem more than anything else. So my goal for 2024 is to place a bit more value on those relationships and then, you know, some form of physical exercise. So maybe if I really get it right, it would be doing some form of physical exercise while seeing friends. That's the productivity efficiency person in me that's going, how can I kill two birds with one stone here?
Can your friend swim? Because if they can swim, then you can have
That'd
a jaw.
That'd be great, yeah.
So speaking of which, like, what does 2024 look like for Sean? Like, what is, you're busy with quite a few things which are very exciting. Maybe you can tell us about that. But what, apart from your goals, what do you want to do in 2024? What does that look like for you?
It's a good question in the sense that this year has been, I said it to you earlier, this year has been somewhat of a unicorn year. At least that's the way I phrased it. I chose a word at the beginning of the year to do a podcast with another friend called Have You Asked Your Dad? and we chose a word of the year, and my word was the word brave. To which he said, that's a weird thing that you would choose brave for 2023, because to get to this point, you've been brave, you've been courageous. And we had a bit of a back and forth on that. But this year really has been an outstanding one for me in the sense that things have changed in so many ways. I don't know that I can keep that going for 2024. I've done a lot of great things and things have fallen into place for me in 2023, especially considering 2022, I really didn't know what the next year was going to hold. So with that lens, I have no idea what 2024 is going to hold. I'm very excited about where I am now, much more so than I was a year ago. So I'm hoping that that excitement level carries through into the things that I do. I trust that I'm going to be maybe a bit more discerning with the projects that I take on. What drains me, I'm a little bit more aware of what drains me and what gives me energy. And hopefully I can choose more of the give me energy things than the things that drain me. Right now, I'm very focused and very much concerned about health. I think I always have been, but physical health, mental health, yes, but physical health. Like, will my body still be able to do the things that it does in 2 years' time, right? I have a child that needs to be picked up and moved around. I would love to be active into my 50s. I don't want to be sitting around at home and become too sedentary. I want to get out and do things. And I'm hoping that maybe I can create the time and the space. I have to create the time and the space to make those things happen in 2024.
Sean, thank you so much for your time. It's really been such a privilege to get to know you the last like hour or so. And I think I'm thankful for being so vulnerable and sharing the stories that you have. I think you've definitely inspired my way of thinking about a few things in watching your podcast or listening to your podcast and listening to you today. And I thank you for doing the things that you do, for opening up these conversations, for creating platforms for people like your sweater says, helping other people to lift their voices and to lift their dreams. I really think what you're doing is very inspiring, both from a dad level, work level, and that's really something that I've enjoyed getting to know you. We've got at the end of our podcast, we ask a few quick fire questions. So I'm going to just ask you the question and you answer with the first thing that pops up in your head.
Give it a go.
Which book are you currently reading?
I just finished a book. I haven't picked up a new one. Oh, How to Feel Better by Ruth Kudzi. I have started reading.
Sounds good. Sounds like something that I should also read. Best piece of advice you've ever received? I hope there's so many options that you have to work through.
I want to give this the time that it deserves. The best piece of advice I have, I've received lots of advice, I suppose. Now I've left it so long, this is going to have to be like really profound, and it's not going to be.
We can come back to it later if you wish.
I can't think of something that's powerful, unfortunately. It's probably advice that I would give, but not that I've received.
What is the advice that you would give then?
Give it time.
Name one item on your bucket list.
Ooh, for what? Like for my podcast or for travel or for life?
Whichever.
I need a new pair of shoes, actually. That's okay. But a bucket list. I'd love to travel with my family.
What series are you currently watching?
I don't watch TV.
Favorite sports to watch or play?
To watch, I still enjoy watching swimming, which is weird because there's underwater so much you can't really see anything. being in the water, it's my happy place.
Do you still swim a lot?
No. Need to fix that for 2024 too, hey?
Maybe. What's your favorite outdoor activity?
I mean, I would say swimming there again, but just for variety. Currently walking, and if I can name a place, speed. It's wonderful just to be out in nature. So,
sure. Final question. Complete the sentence. Life is all about
what you put in.
Thank you so much, Sean.
Really only a pleasure. Thank you very much. This has been loads of fun and a bit of a therapy session for myself too. So thank you for the invitation.
Thank you, Sean.
Discover what you're really capable of by listening to Something Shifted with Sean Lewis, available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. You can also find him on Instagram and LinkedIn at Sean Lewis. Thanks for listening to the Framework to Flourish podcast, hosted by Marco Haasbroek and produced in collaboration with Imagine This. For today's episode, Stefanie de Toey was our coordinator, with Kayla Netling as the assistant. John Rehoog was our technical producer and Karina Kloppers our content producer. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram or LinkedIn at Flourish Workshops to stay up to date with our latest episodes, workshops and retreats. Until next time, keep going and growing.